Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. Welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Juneteenth is tomorrow. What's the right way to celebrate it?
And what are we really talking about when we're talking about the algorithm?
But first, the legislative session is officially over after lawmakers struck a deal to craft a budget over the weekend. To do it, they had to make some big cuts, big enough to fill a $1.4 billion deficit. And a lot of those big cuts came as a hit to one of the biggest challenges facing the state, water. Lawmakers completely swept funds meant for the Water Infrastructure Financing Authority, or WIFA. That was bulked up under former Governor Doug Ducey in 2022 to speed up water projects and bring water to Arizona from elsewhere. And while they talked a good game early in the session, lawmakers went home without passing a whole lot of major efforts to address our state's water future. Columnist Joanna Allhands writes about water in the opinion pages of the Arizona Republic, and she's on the line now to talk more about it all. Good morning, Joanna.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with WIFA and the significance of the funding cuts here. What's the backstory here? Like, why did lawmakers and the governor, the former governor, put so much money into WIFA a few years ago?
Well, I mean, I think you can just look around and see that we have a water situation in Arizona, and we've known this for a very long time. We need to conserve the water that we have, but we're also going to need additional supplies. And additional supplies are not cheap. That is expensive water, and it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to find that water and distribute it, get it to the people that need it. So it's a huge effort. It's something that's going to take a lot of money. And so 3 years ago, the legislature and the governor set aside what they had promised to be $1 billion for finding sort of these long-term augmentation supplies, basically to find more water for Arizona.
Yeah.
And but that amount was split over 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And it's rarely kind of made it into the program, right?
Well, the first year obviously got funded. The $333 million got in the first year. Hey, we did good. Second year, only maybe about half-ish got there. Mm-hmm. The rest sort of went to other things, even though there was money in the budget. I mean, we certainly could have had that money. This year, staring down, you know, a pretty decent-sized deficit, there is no money heading to that fund.
Okay. How much of this has had to do with desalination and former Governor Doug Ducey's push to fund that effort?
Well, I think that was definitely the huge black eye that happened at the beginning. You know, once the money was in this fund, the governor was about to leave office and made this last minute pitch for a favored desalination effort in Mexico that would bring water to Arizona. And it was something that had been sort of quietly whispered about pretty much all that session, saying, oh, really, that's what this money is going to go to. And everybody sort of publicly said, no, 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 that's not what we're going to do. And then lo and behold, that was the push. Mm. Now, granted, WIFA is completely backed away from that. They're not pursuing that deal. They're now saying, all right, look, let's try to figure out a way to fairly evaluate all different types of proposals for how we're going to get the water. Really, what matters is that the water is wet and it gets to people when we need it.
Mm. So WIFA has done quite a bit, it sounds like, even without the full $1 billion funding. What does it mean, you think, for the state's water future that we're not funding this year? Could there be some real long-term implications here?
I think so, if this is something that continues. So, you know, hey, I get it. We have a deficit. We're out of money. Things are going to have to, you know, something has to give mm-hmm. this year. I get that. But, you know, if we go 2, 3, 4 years, you know, and don't end up putting additional money towards this goal, and not only just this goal, you know, there is also WIFA is using, also has money for, you know, water conservation efforts that they've been doing too. And they've already given out the money that they have for that. But they could do a whole lot more. There is so much need and interest for additional monies there too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just fall behind the longer it takes for us to get those additional monies in the can and being able to start making plans for this stuff, because it's not cheap and it takes a long time.
Yeah, it takes a long time. Okay, so then there's the broader picture at the legislature this session. Lawmakers and the governor talked a lot about water early in the session. You wrote that they introduced more bills on water than we probably ever seen before.
There was a lot, yes.
But not a lot of it kind of seems to have made it to the finish line, right?
Well, you know, actually, in the very, very last part of the session, there was a ton of flurry, and there were some efforts to address kind of some urban groundwater issues that we had mm-hmm. that were in this giant omnibus bill that did die and that were then resurrected and did end up passing in some smaller bills. And so it's largely what was proposed there, but in some slightly different configurations. So there's a lot of people are still really trying to weed through, wait, what just happened? What happened there? It could be something that's pretty wide reaching. But I think people are really just trying to get their hands around, like, wait, what did you do?
Right.
With the rural groundwater issue. And that was something that people talked about all session. I mean, it was something that people just worked on, and efforts died, and people came back to the table and compromised, and then efforts died again, and all that sort of happened. And at the very, very end, the very last day, a bill came back on that as well, and it very narrowly died.
Hmm. And so on both of these fronts, we made a little bit of progress, maybe at least on the urban front. This has to do with sort of groundwater for developments being built in and around the Phoenix area. We're not sure exactly what the impact of these will be, or it sounds like if the governor will veto this.
Yeah, that's the big question. You know, there is a governor's water council meeting today, and there's lots of speculation today about what's going to be discussed there. What's going to happen? Is the governor going to take parts of what passed? Will she agree to everything? Will she veto everything? There's a lot of questions about what happens next.
So last minute here, Joanna, tell us a little bit about what could happen next, though, on a broader front. The governor has said all along that if the legislature fails to do anything significant to do with water this session, she'll have to step in and kind of do it herself. What does that mean exactly?
Well, that was the big ballyhoo at the very beginning of the session. I mean, she used some very, very strong words to lawmakers saying, basically, if you don't do it, I will. And so there's a lot of speculation about what that means, too. You know, she's sort of been dropping hints kind of throughout the session that she may come into some of the rural groundwater basins that don't have any sort of regulation, especially the ones that are showing the most problems with water, mm-hmm. and designate them as an active management area, which is the state's most stringent regulation, and one where a lot of farmers in those areas say, this simply won't work for us. This is too much for us. Mm. So it really could start a huge fight that, frankly, I don't know that I want to fight.
We'll see what happens then. Columnist yeah. Joanna Allhands with the Arizona Republic joining us. Joanna, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much.
The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act requires American institutions to return to their tribes the remains of indigenous people and artifacts that were dug up, stored, and sometimes displayed in museums around the country. But it's a process that is easier said than done, as our next guest found. Aspen Ford is one of a group of student journalists at the Howard Center for Investigative Journalism at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, who worked on a series of stories about NAGPRA and how well some of Arizona's biggest institutions are doing in returning their archives of human remains. They found ASU has made only 2% of its indigenous remains available for tribes, one of the lowest rates in the country. I spoke with Ford more about it.
NAGPRA actually came out over 30 years ago. It came out in 1990, and it basically mandated that American institutions repatriate or return the Native American remains and funerary objects that they have in their collections. So this came about after years and years of people excavating Native American grave sites and taking the remains to be stored in boxes. Some were studied. And so this law kind of mandated people change the way that they look at archaeology and, return the ancestors back to their tribes. People were still displaying artifacts and other things in their museums up until very recently. Actually, earlier this year, NAGPRA updated its guidelines and mandated that museums stop putting Native American artifacts on display.
Yeah, so these efforts to return and repatriate these remains are relatively new. So institutions around the country are supposed to be doing that, right? And you're looking at two major institutions here in Arizona, ASU and U of A here, to see how their progress has been in repatriating these remains. What did you find?
So I mainly investigated ASU, but I also was involved with U of A to an extent. At the beginning of our research, our first interview was with the U of A, the Arizona State Museum, which is located on its campus. And we met with several people all working on NAGPRA. There were three, and they were very open with us, very happy to tell us all the details of their collections. They are re-inventorying everything. They're turning it digital. They really showed us how extensive this process can be of repatriation. It takes a lot of work to track down things. Often they get remains that aren't identified in any manner. People didn't take the best notes when they were excavating, and they just don't know where these remains came from. Another thing they said is, like, sometimes amateur archaeologists would come and actually just drop off a whole collection of remains and not say anything. It was passed down from a grandfather who had passed away or something like that, and they didn't have any use for them. They didn't know what to do with them, and so they were given to Arizona State Museum. So they've made bigger efforts to repatriate, and that shows in their notices of inventory completion, which all institutions are required to submit to the National Park Service, which oversees NAGPRA. And then we have ASU, which, I mean, we had the records from the NPS stating that ASU had only repatriated less than 2% of all its human remains and artifacts. And then everything changed when we got the FOIA documents from the National Park Service, which showed us their grant applications for 2019 and 2023. And it also showed us progress reports for the years after 2019.
What did they say?
So there was a few things it said. ASU did try to hire its first full-time staff position for repatriation in 2019, but this person was not hired until 2022. And we found through the application that it was kind of a bureaucratic delay in that the contracting office did not approve the position to be funded because they were unfamiliar with NAGPRA and why it should be funded in the first place. And then the pandemic came along and derailed the process. It also stated that the archaeology department acknowledged that the records that they had given to NPS were likely inaccurate, and they actually held more remains and artifacts than they previously thought. ASU also disclosed that it had lost track of some of the Native American remains. Some were stored in old boxes and bags that were ripping. There was even a wastewater flood that entered one of the collections room and flooded the library. They said that no human remains were damaged in this flood, but there was still a flood. And so that kind of, you know, raised questions to us, like, well, how are they taking care of these remains and objects all these years? It just kind of showed us the inner workings of repatriation at ASU that we had no other way to find.
So what did ASU have to say about what you found here?
So we reached out to several people at ASU, several people working at the repository at the archaeology department. And we even reached out to the VP on tribal relations, and they all declined an interview with us. So we were not able to really get anything from them. They did, however, send us a kind of like a press release that stated their goals and how they are now working with tribes and how they are planning to start a new master's program just for repatriation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the day that they sent us that, they also published a press release on their article with the same information
mm-hmm.
that they gave us. And unfortunately, we were never able to get an interview.
So I know you grew up in a town that's home to two Cherokee tribes, and you wrote about this and as part of this project. You and a few of the other students who are Indigenous wrote about covering this as Indigenous people, right? Did you know about NAGPRA growing up in your community?
No, I didn't. So I'm from Tahlequah, Oklahoma. It's home to the Cherokee Nation and also the United Kituwa Band of Cherokee Indians, which I am a part of the latter. And no, I had no idea. I only found out about it a couple years ago through the Indigenous Journalists Association, which I'm a member of. Each year at their conferences, they hold panels talking about repatriation and how to report on that. And then about a year ago, ProPublica really shined a light on the issue with their investigation, looking at it at a national level.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you first hear of what it is, sometimes you don't know like the grim backstory behind it. You just hear like, oh, how did these museums get all these human remains? Like,
yeah.
It's kind of like a no-brainer to a lot of people nowadays. Like, yeah, you should give the remains back to the tribes. But when you start to learn about the history of like how Native American ancestors were treated, it's more an ethical dilemma that you think about, and kind of it shines light on the ethics of archaeological research and excavations back in the day.
Yeah. So I want to ask you lastly about sort of goals in this, right? Like as a journalist, obviously, you know, we're not supposed to be personally invested in our stories, but this one probably hits home for you. Do you want more kids growing up today in places like where you're from to be aware of this, to know, and institutions to change because people are aware?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think it would be really important for Indigenous youth, Indigenous workers, Indigenous journalists to learn about this issue, because it's something that's, it's hard. It's hard to learn about, and not that it's hard to understand, but it's difficult to grasp mm-hmm. the true history of what happened. And even with this generation's archaeologists and museum curators, they are way more pro-repatriation than they've ever been before. I think more awareness is key. And like I said, it is a really hard issue to talk about. It's grim. It's depressing even. But I think that we should all know about this part of American history that took place that not a lot of people know about.
All right. We'll leave it there. Aspen Ford, investigative journalism master's student at Arizona State University's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Aspen, thank you for coming on. Thanks for your reporting here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, one band's return to complex concept art.
The song is not so much a retelling of the story of Joan of Arc, but rather an exploration of that idea of kind of transcendent visitation. In my reading, that's sort of what happened to Joan in the garden when she first is visited by these angels, by these saints.
The lead singer of The Decemberists breaks down their newest project.
But first, Juneteenth will be celebrated tomorrow. But how should we celebrate it? 3 years ago, President Joe Biden declared Juneteenth a federal holiday, following a year in which there was a national reckoning with racism marked by protests over police killings of unarmed black people. But our next guest says this is a holiday that's been celebrated for much, much longer than the last few years when most of us learned about it. Dr. Sean Harper is a provost professor of education, business, and public policy at the University of Southern California, and he's written about the missteps and setbacks that have marked the way corporations have celebrated Juneteenth since 2020. I spoke with him more about it all and how we might celebrate it tomorrow.
Juneteenth first originated following the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, which effectively was intended to end slavery here in the United States. It's just that somehow folks forgot to tell Black people in Galveston, Texas, that they were free. It took 30 months for them to get the news. once they got that news, as you might imagine, they were quite thrilled to know that they were no longer slaves, right? So that was the origination of the holiday. And since that time, not just in Galveston, but really in communities all across America, African Americans have gathered annually to celebrate that historic day when folks in Galveston and elsewhere were supposedly free.
Yeah, yeah. And you talk about the idea that this was a holiday before it became a federal holiday, right? Like it was a holiday because the people who celebrated it saw it as a holiday, made it a holiday, right? Not because of some federal declaration.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one of the things that makes Juneteenth especially unique and quite special is that it is the people's holiday. Black folks created this holiday and this annual celebration that really overflows with authentic Black cultural traditions. So yeah, you're exactly right that this was a holiday long before President Joe Biden declared it so.
So I want to also talk about why Juneteenth kind of went mainstream a few years ago. This wasn't kind of because of a collective sense of the need to celebrate Black history. It was because of a national reckoning with racism and police violence against Black Americans.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Following the murder of George Floyd, several corporations and educational institutions and the federal government and others were scrambling to figure out a way to right the wrongs of structural and systemic racism. The problem is twofold. The righting of those wrongs lasted for not more than 6 months. So it was very performative. The other thing is that, you know, many corporations and other institutions made these commitments to advance racial justice. And they did so in the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, but they never fulfilled those commitments. So one of the things that I will applaud President Joe Biden for doing is making Juneteenth a federal holiday, a national holiday. That made it not so performative, right? That there were just all of these other performative actions that were happening elsewhere. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about what that looked like, right? Like, how did corporate culture kind of initially respond to this recognition of Juneteenth and want to do something?
Yeah, they responded in quite a silly way. There was nothing about it that was laughable, but it was really silly. Walmart, for example, rolled out a Juneteenth edition ice cream. Black people didn't ask for that. Walmart also created this product line of all sorts of Juneteenth paper products and banners and all sorts of other ridiculous things. You know, what was so problematic about that, not just in Walmart, but in other places that were corporatizing the holiday, is that those things were the antithesis of what an authentic, longstanding Juneteenth celebration actually is, was, and continues to be. You know, when you go to a Juneteenth celebration, and I'm 48 years old. I've been to at least 20 Juneteenth celebrations over the course of my life. You know, there's drumming. There are powerful tributes to ancestors and elders who paved the way for future generations. There's authentic soul food. It just overflows with what feels like such authentic Black culture. So the corporatization of it all really just stripped the cultural beauty of what Juneteenth always has been.
So, I mean, let's talk about that more, a little bit about the kind of the quote unquote right way to celebrate this, right? Like there's a corporate level to this and how companies maybe should respond and recognize this holiday for their employees. And then there's also the kind of how the rest of us might respect and honor this holiday, right?
Right. Well, I have a couple ideas.
Yeah.
Many of these corporations have too few Black employees. Notwithstanding, they have Black employees, at least some. They should start by engaging their Black employees and their Black employee resource groups to invite their feedback and their input on what an authentic celebration of Juneteenth can and should look like for the business. They should also ask their clients and Black people in their communities, hey, our company wants to show up in the best and most appropriate and most respectful way on Juneteenth. What advice do you have for us? If you ask the people, they will tell you.
Yeah. What about for those who didn't know about this before, for those who are not part of this community, are there ways in which we can honor and respect this holiday?
Yeah, I'm a professor, so I am a big proponent of assigning things to people to read.
Yeah.
You know, there have been so many really great histories written of Juneteenth, book-long histories, as well as short articles that folks can read to get a sense of not only the origins, but also the evolution of this holiday and the ways that it has been celebrated over time in communities all across America. So I think folks should first start by reading. There's also a thing that happens in many communities across the country on Martin Luther King Day, where people commit themselves to a day of service, you know, doing some act of service in pursuit of social justice in the name of Martin Luther King. I think that committing oneself to doing something really meaningful on Juneteenth is another way that folks can authentically show up. It doesn't necessarily have to be doing service in a Black community. It could be that one commits oneself to reading or engaging with, you know, Black friends of theirs, Black coworkers of theirs, and so on, to try to better understand the cultural significance of the holiday on that holiday. But whatever it is, I think it should become an annual day of commitment for both individuals and for corporations and other organizations.
Yeah. That is Dr. Sean Harper, Provost Professor of Education, Business, and Public Policy at the University of Southern California. Dr. Harper, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us about this, for educating us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Most of us come into contact with algorithms pretty much every day, whether we're picking a show to watch, a song to listen to, a post to like, or a new product to buy. All sorts of companies, websites, and platforms use algorithms to put new things in front of us. But lots of people worry about this and whether we're losing our say in some of the decisions we make. There are also privacy concerns and just philosophical ones as well. My next guest delves into all of this in an essay in the Yale Review, which also serves as a review of two books about algorithmic thinking and culture. Anna Scheckman is a writer and Klarman Fellow at Cornell University. She joins me. And Anna, do you think there's any truth to the feeling that algorithm is one of those words that, like, everyone uses, but fewer actually know what it means and what it is? Do you buy into that?
Yeah, I do. There's a term we have for this. It's an SAT word. It's called a hypostasization, right? Which is a fancy way of saying it's an abstraction, right? It's a thing that doesn't quite exist, but we talk about it as if it does, as if it's a concrete thing. And so part of my hope is to point to the concrete things that we really mean when we're talking about the algorithm as some sort of menacing specter haunting our world.
Right. Well, and it is something that clearly we come into contact with, even if it's just sort of indirectly, on a regular basis, right? Like if we watch Netflix or if we're reading news stories on our phones or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And I think what we mean there are these algorithmic recommendation systems, right? Which is to say that the algorithm itself is not real, right? It's not something we can point to as a single accessible piece of code that these companies are hiding from us, right? But there is a feeling that's attached to this notion of the algorithm, which is a feeling of waning agency, right? Lack of agency. We didn't opt into this. We've just had to adapt to these new norms of basically consumption. And that feeling is real. It's just that the algorithm itself is instead a sort of new technology that intersects with very old forms of legal, economic, and political systems, right, that we've actually always existed in. And in fact, we do have agency over as both consumers and as voters.
Well, so the agency issue is so interesting because, as you point out, algorithms are trained to sort of take their cues from what we do, right? Like if you click on something that you like, the algorithm is going to learn for whatever platform or function you're using, that particular algorithm is going to learn, okay, Anna likes this movie, maybe she will also like this movie. So like we do have agency and we are to some extent the ones in control.
Right. That's right. Although, again, as I say, it oftentimes doesn't feel that way. Yeah. Right. And so that's the strange paradox of this particular form of what I actually like to think of as just advertising. Right. So a way to kind of remind us that we do actually know what this is like. The difference is that where we tend to think of advertising as selling us things that are for someone like us or someone that we could be if only we buy X, Y, or Z product. And algorithmic recommendation systems, because of their capacity to basically be trained on data that we've provided to them, are instead selling us things that are for not just someone like us, but someone that we have been, right?
Right. Well, do you think the fact that the algorithm for, again, for whatever function we're using it for, is sending us stuff for who we are as opposed to maybe who we are aspirationally or in our minds, does that maybe contribute to some of our negative feelings toward sort of, quote unquote, the algorithm?
You know, it might. But again, I think one of the things that's most menacing about the idea of the algorithm is that it's new, right? Is that it's something that is new and therefore dystopian in a way, right? Like it hasn't existed and therefore we don't know how it's going to exist. But there are certain ways that it is just a new form of advertising. So we have a certain way of thinking about advertising. You know, I still get analog mail, get catalogs for things that I didn't sign up for. And that's, you know, frustrating in and of itself. And I'm not sure that we need to necessarily think about the advertising that we get online, even though it is more targeted to our recent consumer behavior, as any more or less frustrating. I think the larger questions we need to be asking are questions that, in fact, we've been asking in our democracy for more than 100 years, which is, should advertising be so attached to the information we receive when we're reading the newspaper, or in this case, you know, reading X or Twitter, whatever we want to call it?
Yeah.
Should there be a profit motive underlying, you know, the information that we're receiving? Is that the best and healthiest thing for our democracy?
Well, and you do hear a lot of folks saying anecdotally, you know, I was talking to a friend about such and such, and then, you know, 5 minutes later, I looked in my Facebook feed and there was an ad for that, or I looked in my email or whatever website I was browsing on and there was an ad for that. It's like almost like, you know, they're listening to us, you know, they, again, sort of big algorithm is kind of listening to us and, you know, hearing what it is that we're interested in and then targeting ads for that very product right to our eyeballs.
Right. And I won't pretend that that's not totally terrifying, because I also find it totally terrifying. But again, that they, right, that abstract, anonymous, shadowy they is something that I think if we continue to talk about it in those terms, actually reproduces our sense that we don't have any power over it. And so instead to attach that they to the very human agents and actors who are developing not only the individual platforms and products that we're using that seem to be listening in on us, but also, you know, the government agencies that have some oversight over these companies. And so instead of thinking paranoically, but also maybe accurately, that they are listening to us, perhaps we should think about, you know, the Federal Trade Commission, which has some ability, you know, historically in the last 50 years, not a tremendous amount of ability, but some ability to actually question whether or not, you know, these companies should be allowed to merge together, and therefore our, you know, fridge can talk to our phone, which can talk to our television, right? That's all a function of whether these companies can have increasing scope into our lives. And there are real people attached to both those companies and those federal agencies, which means, again, that we can identify them, we can lobby them. We don't just have to be terrified of our phones, which in fact can't do very much at all in and of themselves.
Yeah. Well, so how do you think we can go about becoming, I guess, less afraid or less nervous about or less angry at the algorithm? Again, you know, using air quotes around that, like, how do we try to understand sort of what they do and how we impact them, and maybe learn to sort of, you know, learn to live with them a little bit?
Right. I mean, I think what we have to remember is that there are, you know, real benefits to the technological advancements that have contributed to, quote unquote, the algorithm, right? It presumes that what we value kind of above all is efficiency. And we have to ask whether that efficiency is worth the cost of, say, decreased privacy, maybe even decreased security when we're talking about, say, TikTok. So is efficiency worth it is really the question. And if it's not, then we actually do have say. I mean, right, that's the point. We do have say if we decide as consumers and as a collectivity of consumers whether the efficiency is worth it at all costs or whether we value privacy or security more.
Anna Shackman is a writer and Klarman Fellow at Cornell University.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody, joined in studio by the show's Sam Dingman. Hey there, Sam.
Good morning. Mark, I have a question for you.
Yeah, of course.
Are you a fan of prog rock?
Huh. Well, I guess it depends on exactly how prog we're talking, but who doesn't love a good concept album, right?
I would say it depends on the concept, but I'm always intrigued by an album that is intended to be experienced like a film or a TV show, where the idea is that you sit and take the whole thing in, start to finish. And personally, my first introduction to albums like that came from the band The Decemberists.
Yeah, they have a few albums like that, right?
They do. The most popular ones are The Crane Wife and The Hazards of Love.
Those are not new, though, right? Like mid-2000s or so?
Also correct. But last Friday, The Decemberists released their first studio album in 6 years. It is called As It Ever Was, So It Will Be Again. And while it's not one of those full-blown end-to-end narrative records, it does conclude with a 19-minute song about Joan of Arc that is basically a mini concept album. And this album has all the hallmarks of a Decemberist record. It's a blend of hyper-literate lyrics, complex storytelling, intricate instrumentals.
That sounds like a lot. It's like a tricky balance, a fine line to walk.
Yes, but for the band's lead singer, who I spoke to recently, Colin Malloy, finding that balance is the best part.
That's sort of, at the end of the day, what I live for in songwriting. And songwriting is really doing a puzzle. There's these constraints, and constraints are good. You know, obstacles are good because they can create more vibrant and more interesting work.
Yeah. I'm reminded as you're talking about that puzzle and that challenge of there's a moment towards the end of Hazards of Love where there's no way to summarize the story in the space of this interview, but, you know, there's characters on horseback dashing towards this river that is raging, and they're going to have to find a way to get over the river to the other side to escape pursuit.
And in water, you loom so deep and wide.
You build us up to that moment story-wise, but then, in my mind, the music kind of tells the story of how they get across the river. The music gets very violent, and there's lots of different sonic elements clashing against each other. And in my mind, at least, you imagine the characters.
They make it.
Yeah. But there's no words that convey that. You just kind of give way to the music there.
Yeah, well, I mean, so much of this stuff is intentionally left up to the listener's interpretation.
Mm.
And like, I think that you came to that conclusion. And that might be different from my conclusion. That's not to say that either one is right or wrong.
Yeah.
And then that's what makes the work kind of living and make it be a kind of a collaborative thing between the writer and the listener.
Well, there's a part like that in Joan in the Garden on the new record. Tell me about what's happening in the middle of that song.
That's hard to say. I mean, the Joan in the Garden piece the song is not so much a retelling of the story of Joan of Arc, but rather an exploration of that idea of kind of transcendent visitation. In my reading, that's sort of what happened to Joan in the garden when she first is visited by these angels, by these saints. And that's sort of the kernel of that story that I find interesting. I mean, at the time, I'm sure it was like, well, of course she was visited by angels. That's just a thing that happens.
Right.
But now, you know, as we, in our modern times, you wonder about hallucination. You wonder about mental illness.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that I wanted to explore in the story of Joan. And so that section is really a way of expressing that and having that moment occur the best way we can in sort of an audio experience. My hope would be that the listener sitting with headphones or good speakers or something really, you know, intentionally listening to that part, even though that may be challenging, particularly in this day and age, but to get to that place, that transcendence and that sort of hallucination that Joan might have experienced.
Yeah. Another recurring theme across your records, for me at least, is not just falling in love, but how we are supposed to love each other, and critically, how much of that love or of this life matters after death, whether we're talking about the death of a relationship or the death of the body.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of heartbroken ghosts in my songs and heartbroken survivors being followed by ghosts.
So how much of that part of your brain was on your mind on Burial Ground, which is another song from the new record?
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of chipper melody along with, you know, but then you listen closer, like, oh, well, they're actually hanging out in a cemetery.
Yeah.
I mean, as a teen, you know, I found myself hanging out with my friends in cemeteries from time to time.
Yeah.
You know, as young people, as you're starting to know yourself and understand yourself, that draw to that signal of everyone's mortality, I think is kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
This world's all wrong, so let's go where we belong. Back up the stereo, meet at the burial ground.
I think that kind of goes to that fascination of mine of marrying those two very different feels. And yeah, I mean, I think it's a question also. I mean, I think on this record, probably less dying and more kind of reflections on death and mortality.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I think that as leading off the record, I think kind of sets that tone.
So coming back to this question of how much and whether to direct the listener's experience of the story, another interesting case study for me here is The Crane Wife, which in the version that I have, the last song is Sons and Daughters. But if I'm not mistaken, there's a version of it that ends with the song After the Bombs.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me about that is, to my experience, which obviously is not objective, Sons and Daughters is a very hopeful, redemptive sort of song. And After the Bombs is a little bit more melancholy.
Yeah.
How did you approach the decision of which version of the ending to settle on?
Well, that's always a funny story. I mean, I think that was in an era, you know, when there was all these competing, they weren't even streaming services then, just places to download music.
Yeah.
And I think there was this effort to create incentives, you know, so you would be asked to add tracks to the end. Of the, I don't know, that was like the iTunes version or something like that.
Yes, and it was.
And I never liked doing it because there is, you know, the sequences of these records, and certainly the first song and the last song are super critical.
Yeah.
And Sons and Daughters was always the ending song.
When we arrive, sons and daughters will make
know, that's the note that I want to end on.
Okay.
But then we were impelled to put one of the kind of cast off outtakes onto the end of it. And it happened to be after the bombs. And I was so bummed. I was like, but how many people are going to do that? And they're going to think, I don't think it was till after the fact that I realized that there was going to be this whole swath of our listenership that would think that After the Bombs is the last song on that. I mean, in my head, Sons and Daughters is the last song. But,
yeah.
You know, it's not mine, too. It kind of belongs to everyone at this point.
Sure. Yeah, totally. I mean, the last line of After the Bombs is Till It All Starts Over Again. And,
oh, right. yeah, know. Maybe that. And then your iTunes shuffle would put it back.
Yeah.
Start it at the top.
Right. So it, if nothing else, it forces you into thinking about this question.
Right. Yeah, maybe that is the better ending for it.
All right. Well, that was Colin Molloy, lead singer of the Decembrists. Their brand new record is called As It Ever Was, So It Will Be Again. Colin, thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for talking to me. Till it all starts over again.
And if you're interested, the Decembrists will be playing at the Van Buren in Phoenix on July 20th.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can follow us on Instagram. All the cool kids are doing it. We are at KJZZ The Show. And if you've heard a song you liked on today's program, maybe in addition to what you heard from the Decembrists, you can now follow us on Spotify. All you got to do is search KJZZ's The Show on the app. Find all the music we have played in May that will be updated as well.
That's it for this episode of The Show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.